Today is March 18th, 2020. Just 6 days ago, I walked up the steps of the pale yellow brick building known as the Administration Building on the Ball State University campus. It was 7:50 a.m. on March 12th in Muncie, Indiana, and well, I don't have to tell you, it was a bit nippy. But in the still of the morning chill, there was something more dramatic happening. Less than 24 hours prior, President Jeffrey Mearns had declared that the university was suspending all in-person classes and would move to remote learning, not for 2 weeks or 4 weeks, but for the duration of the spring semester. On Friday, March 6th, the University of Washington was the first to make the bold but necessary decision to not hold class in person for 2 weeks. By Tuesday, Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, Ohio State, Miami University of Ohio, Rice, Princeton, Hofstra, Berkeley, and many more colleges followed suit. Today, just 12 days since the University of Washington's decision, the world of education has changed as we know it. You'd be hard-pressed to find a school, a college, or a university that has remained open with face-to-face contact. The world, our world, has changed, and together we must get through this dramatic crisis known as coronavirus or COVID-19. It is sweeping our country and is sweeping the globe. Today, millions of college students have now moved out, moved back home. Spring break plans have been changed or canceled, really. And we're not sure what the foreseeable near future really holds. Will this last for 3 weeks, 5 weeks, or 3 months, 5 months? We don't know. And yet it takes a leader to make bold decisions, march forward, and do what is best for everyone. And as you'll hear President Mearns say today, we certainly hope that we look back 60 days from now and think this was an overreaction, thank goodness. But in the case that it may not be an overreaction, we have to do the right thing. President Mearns isn't unlike any other leader across the country who's had to make bold decisions in this state of crisis. So listen today and see just how he made this decision and who he consulted and who's on the front lines for a decision that affected 22,000 students and I dare say 22,000 families as well. President Mearns serves as the 17th president of Ball State University. He joined in May of 2017 and helped to develop a strategic plan. I love the title here. It's called Destination 2040, Our Flight Path. It sets priorities across 5 key areas: undergraduate excellence, graduate education and lifetime learning, community engagement and impact, scholarship and societal impact, and institutional and inclusive excellence. During his tenure, President Mearns has pursued initiatives that have produced the largest freshman class in history and increased alumni engagement and fundraising. President Mearns has also strengthened the university's relationship with the community, most notably through its innovative partnership with Muncie Community Schools. It's a fascinating tale to listen to, really, so you don't want to miss this. You'll want to stay to the end. But President Mearns, Jeff, he is one of 9 children. He is the middle child, number 5, and he followed in the footsteps of his father, who attended an Ivy League institution. As a president of now 2 different institutions, and being the father of 5, President Mearns has a unique perspective on the role of higher education and what it means to trust those around you, seek out transformative experiences, and together, trust and transformation can and will change the trajectory of your life. Well, hello, everyone. I'm your host, Dr. Cynthia Colon, author of the book Tips, Tales, and Truths for Teens. Welcome to Destination University, where we explore extraordinary people who lived ordinary childhoods and found a pathway to college. If you are a parent of a college-bound teen or a champion of one, you are exactly where you're supposed to be. By being here today, you help to grow the community of informed families across the nation. Thank you for joining the movement. This is episode number 57. Today's lesson, trust adults, seek transformative experiences, and change your life trajectory. Okay, now friends, I won't make you wait much longer, I promise, but it should be noted that this episode was scheduled to and will air on Wednesday, April 15th. Consider this an early bonus of episode number 57. After meeting with President Mearns in that pale yellow brick building that's just gorgeous, it was an unprecedented moment to be able to interview someone just on the heels of this decision regarding coronavirus. So I thought it was timely, and I did not want to make you wait until April 15th. So here we go. Enjoy this interview with this amazing leader.
There is no guarantee for success, but there are ways to get closer to it when you do the right things. Who you surround yourself with is just as important as what you do. Finding the right people, the right classes, the right activities, and taking the right tests are all decisions that shape your future. Find out more today on Destination University with Dr. Cynthia Colon. Dr. Colon and her guests will give you the tips you need, whether you're a student, parent, or educator. Now, here is your host, Dr. Cynthia Colon.
Hello, President Mearns, and thank you for being here. Welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to have this conversation.
Oh, my goodness. I am honored to be here. And at the same time, even though we set this appointment a while ago, we are in unprecedented times with colleges and universities. And, you know, I just want to start by asking you, what does it mean to be a president of a major institution and have to make a decision that is going to affect the entire campus?
Well, certainly we understand that from time to time, unexpected things arise. This coronavirus is not just unexpected, but as you suggest, it's unprecedented in terms of its significant and the significance and the risk to our students, our faculty, our staff, and the communities that we serve. So this requires us all to be a little flexible, to continue to respond to changing circumstances, to also have the trust in empowering other people on campus to exercise their judgment and discretion. There's no clear answer to or solutions to the problems, so we have to give general expectations and general guidance and entrust people to use their judgment and draw upon expertise of others. So we've been meeting regularly as a leadership team, and then those who have specific responsibility around these issues have been speaking at least on a daily basis, if not more. And we're making our best decisions that we can as we go from day to day, and recognizing the long-term impact of the decisions that we make. So yesterday, one of the things that helped inform the decisions that we had to make yesterday afternoon and yesterday evening was a recognition that it's not just our responsibility to advance the welfare of the people we serve directly. Mm-hmm. That is, again, our students, our faculty, our staff, visitors to our campus, but that we're part of a national or an international community, and that what we do is not just designed to protect the individuals that we serve directly, but our role in trying to stem this global pandemic, and that we all have a responsibility to play a part and make certain sacrifices and deal with disruption.
Right. I think your keywords there are flexibility and sort of the long term, and also, you know, this is a disruption. It's everybody being inconvenienced, but for the greater good. And so who are sort of your foot soldiers right now on the ground, just, you know, taking those phone calls from students, parents that may be having just sort of, you know, what do I do? Where do I go from here? Things like that.
So it's primarily the people that I'm dealing with directly are the various vice presidents, right, and also the academic deans, because they really are the ones who have to empower and lead their various divisions. But there are also a group of experts. We have a crisis management team that has been pre-established to deal with unexpected events like this. And we also have a separate group with some overlapping membership that deals with the possibility of a pandemic or an epidemic. So we were prepared in general for this kind of event. And so those individuals have been meeting on a regular basis. They've also been conferring with state and national experts. They're on the phone regularly with our colleagues at Ball Memorial Hospital, with the Indiana University Health System, and with county and state public health officials. So we really rely on them to gather the expert information that they bring back to us as a leadership team. And what we're trying to balance is people want clarity, but in an evolving situation like this that is, as you mentioned, somewhat unprecedented, we all have to deal with a little bit of ambiguity as well. And I understand, that causes a bit more anxiety. So we try to be transparent and candid about that. That we don't have all of the answers today, that how we're responding today might differ from what actions we need to take later this afternoon or tomorrow, and just prepare people that it will continue to be an evolving situation, and encourage them to be understanding with us as we continue to evolve. And on our campus, I've been very gratified that so far people have been very respectful, people have been patient, they're asking questions, but they're doing so not out of a great sense of anxiety or upset, but want to join us in making the best decisions we can, both for ourselves and for our communities.
Right. I mean, I think that presidents who made this decision maybe a week ago, I think there was a lot of like, what, why are we doing this? This seems, you know, an overreaction, but I think as the days go and the cases grow exponentially, it just seems like everybody's kind of getting on board, I think. And like you said, they're asking questions and they're feeling a lot of anxiety, but I think hopefully they understand.
Yes, and I think it would actually be gratifying if in 60 days we look back and say, perhaps we overreacted and we stemmed the spread of this disease more quickly than we thought. That would be a good thing.
That would be a good thing. Well, thank you for indulging me in obviously, this feels, you know, a crazy time, and my role and who I talk to, we talk about admissions a lot, and the role that plays in a high school senior and the family's journey. And so I know that you have a vice president in charge of all of that, but maybe just say a word as to what you would say to those families in terms of how they're making their decisions. It's about that time, yield, getting those letters of acceptance and deciding where to go. And what would you say to people who may not be able to or have decided not to visit Ball State?
So we are in the yield season. So yes. Applications are still coming in, but actually this is a time when people are making those important decisions. So I hope that they would see that the decisions we're making are in the best interests of all of the members of our community, including our students. I have five children. Two of them are college seniors. One actually works at a university, and the other is both a student and a researcher at another university. So this is very personal to me. Yes. I do understand my responsibility is that I've been entrusted with the lives and the health and welfare of the children of many people. So so I would say to those parents and those families, we are aware that they have entrusted us with something that is so very precious to them, and that we're going to always make the decisions that are in the best interest of all of our students, as well as our faculty, staff, and our community partners and friends. I would also say that, you know, you're making decisions for where to send your student in August. And I do believe that by the time we get to the summer, we will be beyond the worst part of this crisis, and that perhaps we will have learned some things about how to adjust to other issues if they were to rise when their students are here on our campus. So we're adjusting how we go through this yield season. We're evaluating whether we should continue to have tours. We have an admitted student day where thousands of students and their families come to campus. We have not canceled that yet, but my sense is that's the direction we're heading. We've got a wonderful website with a virtual tour, so we may be directing people to that website. We feel a little bit disadvantaged while it's happening to colleges and universities all across the country. We feel that if we can get prospective students and their families to our campus, that they will be extraordinarily impressed. So we have to figure out how to make that impression virtually.
Well, to your point, I should say to our listeners who are across the country, I have been to Muncie several times, and I've been to Ball State, and I've had the luxury of being able to have, you know, campus tours, and it's a great campus. Love the bell tower, by the way. And so to that point, share with our listeners a bit about what we are looking out, you know, outside your window, and maybe describe what you love most about this place.
So it's a beautiful campus. It has modern buildings, but that are architecturally traditional. We are sitting, as we speak here today, we're sitting in the original academic building of the university. It was built in 1899. So we're in the heart of the old campus, or the old quad. And so we're surrounded, as we look out the window to the west, with the original buildings of the campus that were, most of them were constructed in the 1920s and 1930s, but they've been well maintained, and they're classic structures that we use for a variety of purposes, everything from instruction to advising to our wonderful art museum. But perhaps most importantly, as you look over my shoulder out that window, you'll see the Statue of Beneficence. This was a statue that represents our recognition of the commitment of the five Ball brothers and their families who founded our university in 1918. But more importantly, that statue is the iconic representation of our commitment to the enduring values that have distinguished this university for more than 100 years. They're enduring because these are the values that we still embrace in our strategic plan as we fulfill our mission in our second century. So my office, I get to look out at that same westward-facing window and get to look at beneficence. And I think we all draw inspiration from that beautiful piece of art. So as I say, it's a reminder of what I think is truly distinctive about our public university. We've got wonderful facilities, great academic programs. We got faculty and staff who are personally committed to the success of our students. But I think what makes us distinctive is we are committed to those enduring values.
I love that. And we passed it as we were driving in this morning. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with Indiana, can just share a little bit about the Ball brothers. You mentioned that, and obviously founding the founders of this institution. So talk about the Ball brothers.
So the Ball brothers made glass containers, ball jars. They moved from Buffalo, New York in the late 19th century. They moved to Muncie because at that time there was an abundant supply of natural gas, which is making glass is a very energy intensive manufacturing process. So there was cheap natural gas here to Muncie, in Muncie, in East Central Indiana. So they moved their company here. They were extraordinarily successful in business. But what was truly remarkable about them is they and their families were extraordinarily generous philanthropists. They invested in education and the arts. And so the extended members of the Ball family continue to be involved in education, arts, and health here all across East Central Indiana. And we actually believe that the continuing relationship with the extended members of the Ball family is the longest relationship that a family philanthropic relationship between a family and a public university in the United States. There have been longer relationships between a family, an extended family, and a private university, but we believe it's the longest continuous relationship between a family, philanthropic relationship, and a public university. So we're very fortunate. They're still very active on our campus and in our community. There are three Ball Family Legacy Foundations that continue to contribute to education and the arts and to healthcare and to community engagement. So we're quite fortunate here in Muncie.
You are, and that speaks to the resources that Ball State is able to offer and that what a great luxury that is to have that connection, continued connection.
We are quite fortunate. So when you walk across campus, you'll continue to see the physical manifestation of their generosity. And then if you speak to our faculty and staff and our students, you'll also learn that they've been the beneficiaries of that, of those philanthropic investments.
So good. Listeners, if you didn't catch that, really write that down. And really, when an institution has good partnerships with foundations and generous philanthropists, it really manifests itself in the resources of that institution. So good to know. Well, this is my favorite part of the show. And because really, at the end of the day, listeners like to know and hear about you and your own journey. Everybody has their path to college and their story. And so would you be so kind to share a little bit about your background and your upbringing and what your path was like?
Sure. So I'm one of nine children. Both of my parents were only children. And my father was the only one, was the first in our family to go to college. Mm-hmm. His father was a nightclub singer. His mother was a secretary, or what we would now refer to as an executive assistant. Mm-hmm. And he was bright and a talented athlete and got admitted to Yale. So he went off from New York City to Yale. Mm-hmm. And that educational opportunity that he had transformed not just his life, but transformed and changed the trajectory of our whole family. So of my siblings and of those nine children, eight of us have undergraduate degrees. Probably when you add up all the undergraduate degrees and advanced degrees, there's probably somewhere around 20 to 25 post-secondary degrees in those nine children. So education was a given for us. It was my father then, after serving in the Navy, he went to law school and immediately from law school embarked on a career of 40 years as a law professor. Served twice as a law dean and administrator and a teacher and a scholar and a mentor to lots of students. So education, we like to say education is our family business. And so it wasn't a question of whether I was going to go to college, it was where. Mm-hmm. And interesting, that was actually a point of for some time, a little point of disagreement between me and my father during my senior year. I was a pretty good student, but also a very good athlete.
Okay.
And so I wanted to find a place where I could balance both of them. And so I had my sights set on going to the University of Virginia and studying there and also running cross country and track. Thought that that would be a nice balance, excellent academic school, beautiful opportunity. I was born and raised in Charlottesville. We have a long-standing relationship with the University of Virginia. My father had a different view. His view was that if I got admitted to Yale, if I was lucky enough to be admitted to Yale, that was where I was going to go. So during my entire senior year, we never had the conversation of what if. And we finally had that conversation a couple of days after I received a letter giving me admission to Yale. And so late into one night, we had a long conversation. And at the end of the day, I accepted his suggestion. I used that word in an understated way. So went to Yale. Now looking back many years later, my father was right. It was a wonderful educational experience. It allowed me to continue to compete successfully, but also provide an extraordinary educational opportunity for me. So that was kind of my journey.
But UVA was in your sights later.
Correct.
Am I correct?
That's
okay.
Correct. So after I graduated from Yale, I taught high school English for 3 years at a Catholic prep school in Morristown, New Jersey, called the Del Barton School, and then went off to law school to the University of Virginia. And as I say, our family has a longstanding connection to Yale, but also to the University of Virginia. My son is a senior there. He's about to earn his undergraduate degree, and my oldest daughter earned her master's degree, and a lot of my siblings and nieces and nephews have attended the University of Virginia.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So many things you just said.
Sure.
Okay. First of all, you used the word trajectory, change the trajectory of your family. And your father was first generation to college. We call those FGCs in the admissions world, okay. FGC. And you were one of nine. Where are you in that nine?
I'm the middle. I'm the fifth of nine, right? I'm the quintessential middle child. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but that's where I think
my mom would get along. She's number five of 12.
Wow.
So, yes. Now, it was not a question of whether you were going, but where,
correct?
Right? And I have to imagine you have a soft spot for students who are FGC and what it means for a family to make a decision for sometimes their oldest or only to attend college. So can you speak to that in terms of in maybe as a president, as a leader, specific to Ball State or just in general? What does that mean for you?
So I continue to believe, notwithstanding some of the challenges we face in education and higher education and some skepticism about the value of higher education, I still believe because of that experience and the experiences that I get to see every day, that education and higher education specifically continues to be the most significant transformative influence in the lives, not just of the individual who receives that education, but in that individual's family, their company, and their community. I believe it because I've seen it.
Yes.
And so both of my parents have passed away, but you know, I remind my children all the time about how fortunate we are that for us, education is a given, but for many other people, it's not. And that they should consider themselves quite fortunate to have been the beneficiaries of that educational experience and their obligation like mine to continue to provide those opportunities to as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we hear out in the community, well, college isn't for everyone. Well, college may not be for everyone as soon as they graduate from high school, but all of the data tells us that advanced education after high school is critical to not only having a fulfilling career, but to lead a meaningful life, not just in terms of professional opportunities, but in terms of health outcomes, you know, just go down the list of those factors that provide security, safety, good health, strong family relationships, strong community engagement. There is a very high correlation between education beyond high school and those very important social and economic factors. And so whenever I'm given an opportunity to speak about why I feel fortunate to be involved in higher education, it's because I think it's my responsibility, my obligation, having been the beneficiary of an educational experience that was provided to my father, to provide that opportunity as best I can to other people as well.
I love what you're saying because everybody has their journey. And what you said was college is not necessarily for everyone in this moment, right? The traditional experience is to go from high school to a four-year institution, but so many have other paths, whether it's through the military or through two-year college. But overall, you're right. The research shows that we're going to all have a better quality of life.
We need to do a better job in higher education collectively of providing more entry points.
Yes.
That is, so it's not just when you're 18 or 19 that you can get an undergraduate degree and that it's a four-year or a five-year experience. And so in our strategic plan, we are actually moving very aggressively to provide alternative entry points and alternative educational experiences that can accumulate over time to an undergraduate degree or an advanced degree, so that it's not just this binary choice of college or work.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, various entry points along the way for students or learners to acquire credits or transferable skills that will then either produce a certificate or some kind of a degree.
Oh, I love that. I love what you just said. So critical to really think outside of what has been traditional to this point, right?
Right.
So I think that's amazing.
And we in higher education, frankly, have too often said, are our students ready for us? Are they ready for college? And I think as we see the changing nature of learners, not just students, but of learners, we have to do a better job of saying, are we prepared with courses and structures and admissions processes and financing options, are we prepared for the learners of tomorrow? We have to kind of change the perspective. And that's a difficult thing. I mean, we've got 3,600 faculty and staff who have been, you know, who have over their professional experience have been used to doing it a certain way. Mm-hmm. And to make that change is significant. Now, I'm fortunate here at Ball State, we have a culture of innovation. We have a culture of experimentation and flexibility. So I think we're well prepared to make those changes, but we have some more work to do as well.
Well, I think everybody has work to do. I think that we have changing demographics. We have changes, like you said, the kind of learner that's coming. I don't know if anyone who's born now, I mean, you know, how we read, right? Paper is not really what students are turning their, when they're swiping on their phone or on their, you know, everything is different. And it leaves room for so much innovation and a whole new world of people that can have access, that maybe didn't have access or can imagine themselves earning a degree, because it doesn't have to be that 4-year, but it can be, you know, alongside working or part-time or sort of working their way through.
So I try to articulate that relationship as not so much teacher-student, but on our best days, our faculty and our students are learning partners, that our students are also helping to guide, and that our teachers, our faculty are receptive to what they learn from the students. Again, that is our aspiration. And I think, as I say, on our best days, I think our faculty are doing that in our classes and our laboratories every day already.
Mm, I love that. Oh my goodness. I can continue to talk to you forever. I can tell. So I just want to say out loud to our listeners, parents, if you're listening and you heard President Mearn say that he had University of Virginia on the brain early on, and you pivoted, you made a different decision, and which would turn out to be a great decision for you, but you still ended up at UVA later in life, right? That sometimes seems to happen, right?
Right, it does.
You have your mindset on something that's going to come back to you. Now, I often say that that leadership does not always come in a title. And I can see, I can hear, I can tell already, you've been probably a leader for a long time. When did you know you were a leader? Or, you know, did someone have to point that out to you? Or, you know, when someone's in high school, do you think there's intuition or just knowledge about how am I going to be a leader? Or do you think leadership is taught?
So I think it's more experienced than taught. Mm-hmm. I guess I would say a couple things. First is I agree with your concept that we shouldn't equate leadership with a title. Mm-hmm. We have all known many people who have had titles,
yes,
of either prestige or influence, who have let us down, who have demonstrated that they are not deserving of being considered leaders, that they are not deserving of us following their model. And corresponding, it depends on what you define as leadership. If you define leadership as empowering the success of other people, then it doesn't matter what your title is. You can be in any position in an organization. I'll use the university. You can be a leader by being an advisor, by being an executive assistant. If through your servant leadership approach, you can support the success of other people. And I hope that leadership is defined by is not measured by how successful you are, but how many people you empower the success of other people. So when I look back at my pathway to get to this position, what I would find is that when I look back, you know, starting as an athlete in high school and college, while I was captain of sports teams, I would like to think that the teams got better by virtue of my participation, because I was trying to set an example in terms of how to prepare for competitions. When I was in the Justice Department as a trial lawyer, I was given leadership responsibility in terms of supervising certain sections. And I'd like to look back and think that I was given those opportunities because of how I demonstrated how I went about my work in preparing cases, conducting investigations, participating in trials. So I would encourage those who are thinking about leadership, don't set your path towards a particular title or an outcome. Take full advantage of the opportunity that lies in front of you to not only facilitate your own success, but to empower the success of others. And if you do that, leadership positions in terms of titles will naturally follow. And then you'll be, I believe, you'll be better prepared to fulfill the responsibility that you have when you get those titles.
Well, you couldn't have said better. I mean, it's true. Helping to empower the success of others is really the definition of servant leadership. And when you lift everybody else up around you, you know, you earn their respect, right? Respect doesn't come because you have a title. It comes because you've earned that respect.
Right. And that's why when I speak to students, that view of what leadership is so energizing. Right? Because you can be a leader without a title.
Exactly.
And so to me, it's encouraging that that's the definition of leadership, because it can empower all of us to be leaders in whatever position we have and in whatever relationships we have.
I love that. So in that vein, I wanted to give you an opportunity to share one of your maybe proudest moments of being a leader here at Ball State. I know that shortly after your arrival in May of 2017, I believe you were asked to sort of oversee the Muncie School Board and the selection of the Muncie School Board. So do I have that correctly?
Yes.
Shortly after your arrival. So I don't know if that was your proudest moment, but maybe you can share a little bit about what that means, that relationship.
So I would say two things. I'll speak to that more specifically in just a second, but to me, in my position, what's the most gratifying and most encouraging is the quality of people that want to either continue to work here at Ball State or who are attracted to join us. I think perhaps the most important responsibility I have in the position I occupy is to retain and recruit outstanding leaders all across the campus. And so as I look at the people who report directly to me, as I look at the deans that we have on our campus, both those who were here before I arrived and those who have decided to come to us, to me, that's the most gratifying and perhaps the most important measure of my leadership, because that's where the work will get done. That's where the change will occur. That's where success will be enabled and empowered. Mm-hmm. And also that's where the success will continue long after my service has concluded. So that's the first thing that I focus on is the quality of the individuals. And when I say quality, I go back to certainly they need to have competencies. They need to have professional experience. They need to have qualifications. But what is vitally important to me is, do those individuals, does our mission resonate with them? Mm-hmm. And do they embrace our values? You know, you can teach job competencies. It's hard to change somebody's values when they've been on the planet for 35, 45 years. So we're very intentional in trying to understand a person's values before we entrust them with the very significant responsibility of serving on our campus in any position, whether it's staff, faculty, or leadership position. We really focus on our values. With respect to the Muncie Community Schools, there, you know, that was a somewhat controversial decision when it was made by the legislature, and our support of that legislation was somewhat controversial. But when we were able to separate out some of the elements of the legislation that understandably caused questions and skepticism and some opposition, what we wanted the people in the community to understand is, we viewed this as an opportunity to create and lead a community-wide partnership, to facilitate people all across the community to engage in a single common purpose, which was to provide a quality educational experience to every child in Muncie, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And after the legislation and the debate about the legislation was settled, and as we've gone through the partnership in the first year or two, it's been very gratifying to me that the vast majority of people, even those who either were skeptical about the legislation or who actually publicly opposed it, have said, okay, the political debate is now over. The legislation has passed and the university is now in this position. How can we help? because they shared our common commitment to that education. They may have a different view about whether this mechanism is good or bad, but they've put those differences aside and joined us in educating our children. And I'll tell you what, there are a variety of reasons why we did it. Some of them are professional, some of them are institutional, some of them relate to just what we do in terms of the educational business. But I'll tell you one story, and this goes back to the founding of our university and Beneficence. Everyone knows the relationship between the Ball brothers and the university and Beneficence. But I learned shortly after I arrived, when I was reading the history of the university, about the history of our Emmons Auditorium.
Okay,
this is the largest auditorium on our campus. We host not only campus events, but community events, touring concerts and touring Broadway shows. It's a 3,600-seat wonderful auditorium. It was built in the 1960s. And the funding of it had to be generated through philanthropic support. State of Indiana does a wonderful job in funding academic buildings, but they don't build athletic facilities or performance venues or residence halls. So when you're going to construct any of those, you need to have your own resources. So one of my predecessors, John Emmons, who was the president at the time, set out to raise millions of dollars that was necessary to build that auditorium. And of course, the Ball family foundations and wealthy individuals all across the community made significant contributions. But the piece of the history that was so important to me was I learned that at that time there was payroll deduction for the factory workers in the factories on the south side of Muncie. And there were men and women who were giving nickels and dimes
from
their hourly wages to build this wonderful, to fund this wonderful auditorium that now graces our campus. And it caused me to reflect that the children, particularly those children on the south side of our campus, the areas where they're probably the socioeconomic challenges are the most pronounced in our community, those children who are now in the Muncie Community Schools are the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of those men and women who made those sacrifices to build that auditorium. So to me, it was not just a professional responsibility. This was a moral obligation for us to provide the support, to engage in a way that can ensure those children have the kind of educational experiences that I have the good fortune to provide to my children. We wanted to provide them with those experiences.
Oh my God, that might be the best story I've heard. That's incredible.
And it's true.
And who went out and asked for that? Do you know the story there?
I don't know the specifics of the story, but it's in our history.
Wow.
I mean, it's a remarkable testament. So even though we have divisions in our community,
Everybody does.
Who are on campus,
down and down,
north side versus south side, those divisions still persist. But that story shows that when we have a common cause, our community has the capacity to come together, to work together for that common cause. So that's why I'm encouraged. The challenges are significant. Don't get me wrong. The challenges in our schools, our population health challenges are quite profound. But I'm an optimist. I'm not resigned that those challenges have to persist indefinitely. That if we come together and work together, we have the opportunity to overcome those challenges and provide good outcomes, improve the lives of all of the people in our community.
It's amazing. That is amazing. Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay. We're wrapping up soon, I promise, but I have two questions. And the first really is, because I found this tagline, you mentioned your website, love the website, and I saw, as cardinals, we fly. So maybe speak about that, what that means, or maybe share the values of beneficence, which you have talked about. So
when we developed that marketing campaign, we wanted to preserve some of the traditional elements of our images. So the beneficence, the winged statue, we're cardinals, which is our athletic mascot.
Good.
So it was consistent with those images, but it also was aspirational, right?
Mm-hmm.
That as an institution, we were ascending. And going back to this notion of the transformative power of education, we believe that we can give flight to the dreams and aspirations of our students and our faculty and our staff. So we think that those simple words, very clear, only five letters, give voice to those aspirations that we're here to empower, to enable all of our students to take flight.
Love it. Love it. Okay, finally.
Yes.
You are
a father of five, you said.
Yes.
And what advice would you give to any family out there wanting to raise a college-bound teen? Offer your own tip, tale, or truth, as my book is called, Tips, Tales, and Truths, about parenting in this world of technology and instant gratification, perfectionism, all of those things. What would be the one thing you want to share?
So I'll share this not because I was the role model of what of the advice I'm about to provide, but perhaps talking less. Also, trusting that your children are not just listening to you, but they're watching your actions. And so that if through your actions you're showing the value of education, that those commitments that you make to education, that your children are watching that. Also, at a time, sometimes they don't appear that they're listening or watching. But in my experience, now that my children, my youngest two are 22 years old, I've seen my children. It's very gratifying. Jennifer and I have seen our children grow into the young adults that any parent would want to see their children grow up to be. They've taken different paths. One of my five children had a couple of false starts in higher education and didn't complete. But Christina is, I'm so proud of her. She's doing wonderful things, and she is the kindest, most grateful, and compassionate child that a parent could ever have. So she is living a fulfilling and meaningful life even without a college education. So be flexible. And as I say, trust that your children are both listening and watching you. And so one of the things I learned from my father in particular, that there were undoubtedly times when I disappointed him. And there's a longer story that time doesn't permit for us to talk about right now. But I know that that instead of telling me he was disappointed, he didn't say anything. And I believed he didn't say anything because he trusted that I was more disappointed in myself than he was in me. And as a result, he didn't need to say anything. So sometimes as a parent, you have to refrain from saying anything and trust that you've instilled the right values in your children, and that maybe they won't get there in the straightest line that you could draw for them, but that in time they will get to the right place.
That's not a golden nugget. I don't know what is. Parents, even when you're disappointed, and we often are, we can be, we're human, but there's no need to say it. They're probably just as, if not more, disappointed in themselves than you are. I love that. Oh my goodness. President Mars, thank you so much
Your
time today.
You're very
I'm
welcome.
Going to wrap up. And so just stick with us for just a second and see if I can, you know, pull all this together. Listeners, you have heard today from President Mearns, his tips for parenting and his leadership and what he has as vision for this great institution. And often what we find is when we see how institutions and humans react in a crisis situation, those are our best moments. Those are our best moments. So take note as you are touring around and making choices and making decisions as you get closer to that journey. The theme for today, for me, my biggest takeaways are the three T's that President Mearns mentioned. Trust your intuition, trust the adults around you. Transformative, look out for opportunities that will transform you, your life, and experiences throughout your journey. And when you do that, trajectory, it can change the trajectory of your life and those who will follow in your footsteps. That's all I have for you today, my friends. Thank you for joining us. President Mearns, what an honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That is all I have for you today, my friends. Thank you for tuning in today. If this episode has in any way fueled your confidence or helped build your dreams, please share this episode with three people in the next 30 minutes. Parents and mentors, if you are feeling extra loving today, you can go to iTunes and write us a review. This helps other listeners find us and begin their journey to Destination University. You can join the conversation on our Facebook group, Destination University, open to all parents, no matter your grade level. Come on over and join the conversation and get the insider scoop. Now, as I mentioned, this was an early edition of episode number 57. So next week, we'll get to Ken Anselman, the vice president at Lawrence University. He is quite a hoot, so you don't want to miss that episode. But if you're listening to this episode 57 on April 15th, the insider scoop for next week is that Dr. Andy Bone, senior vice president and chief operating officer of Ivy Tech Community College, will join us. He is our first guest of the community college system across the country. That really is an opportunity for you to learn how really with the cost of college education is continuing to rise. Andy shares how he sees the role of community college, not just here, but across the country, and how it can help you save money in the short and long term. Parents, there are multiple ways to achieve a debt-free degree, and so you just don't want to miss this conversation. And the story of Andy, the story that he brings to the table, is really that of opportunity. And Andy grew up in a rural area, and he himself says he was a poor student, a poor kid, and struggled to find his path to and through college. So he has a different and not a straight path, so you don't want to miss that episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or nominate someone to be a guest on the show, please visit my website, drcynthiacolon.com. And also, if you just want to learn about this summer's essay camps, please visit. Oh, I'm so excited to offer 4 and 5 day camps for the essay camps and the college application boot camp. There is also, you should know, one date that's available for rising juniors called Junior Jumpstart. That's for class of 2022. Okay, I will see you next Wednesday at noon Pacific for another episode of Destination University. Until next week, wherever you are, may you have a happy and sunny day. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for listening this week to Destination University. Be sure to join Dr. Cynthia Colon again next Wednesday at 12 noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Variety Channel, and get one step closer to your success. Are you ready to become the applicant every college wants to admit? Would you like to become the adult that models success? Then join the thousands of students, parents, and educators who have found the perfect solution. Dr. Cynthia Colon, author of Tips, Tales, and Truths for Teens, offers motivational and empowering workshops and keynote addresses for your school or organization. She fuels confidence in students on their road to university life. Cynthia coaches parents, educators, and professionals to model a success mindset for students. Go to drcynthiacolon.com to book her to speak, receive a free consultation, or have her as your personal coach. That's drcynthiacolon.com. Visit the site today.